This is Ryan Dawson of the Anti-Neocon Report, and with me today is Joe Lauria, UN Joe, foreign affairs journalist based at the UN since 1990, and he's written for a number of places. I've been reading articles from Consortium News. Joe, welcome to the program. It's good to talk to you.
Right, Brian. Thank you.
I want to talk about the two rounds for the ceasefire talks in Syria, but I think it would be good and important to cover the situation on the ground preceding the talks, because I think that had a great influence on why there were talks. So what's your opinion on what was going on in the ground preceding these talks this month?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think without the tremendous advances by the Syrian Arab army, backed by Russian air cover and Iranian forces, militia from Iraq, the amount of territory they've taken back in Latakia first, and then in virtually encircling Aleppo and cutting off supplies from Turkey to extremists who are still occupying one half of Aleppo, and then even moving on towards Raqqa, the so-called capital of the Islamic State. All of these moves, and you know they're happening because American officials are testifying to Congress that they're happening. We're not just taking Russia's word for it. So at the beginning, the West tried to, and particularly America, tried to downplay what Russia was doing. They were going to be in a quagmire, Obama said, and that this was, they're killing a lot of civilians. I think everybody's killing civilians, unfortunately, and you can't believe anybody accusing others of being the only ones killing civilians. The Russians were going to do nothing, and in fact, they have done an enormous bit in Syria. They've changed the whole nature of the war. Essentially, Assad is winning. President Bashar al-Assad, and this panicked Russia, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and
they were threatening troops, although Saudi Arabia.
They've been threatening to invade Syria, both of them, to the point where Saudi planes and troops were flying into Turkey, and they were going to move. They only wanted the United States to give the green light. Now, from the U.S. point of view, they still officially want to overthrow Assad. They were doing virtually nothing to attack Islamic State in the year and a half that they began their operation. This is one of the reasons Russia intervened, because they could not stand by and watch this group possibly take over Syria with all the implications that that has for exporting terrorism. And then, of course, what happened in Paris and in San Bernardino, if you could believe those people were actually connected to Islamic State, and more importantly, even the refugee crisis in Europe, it really froze minds in Washington. So they've been stepping up attacks on Islamic State. And they agreed in this whole farcical UN process, the United States did agree to allow Assad to stay on for 6 months at least, and then there'd be a transitional government for a year, during which they would write a new constitution, then there'd be an election, and the U.S. never said that Assad couldn't run again at that point. That's the plan that the U.S. agreed to at the Security Council with Russia. They passed a resolution. So there's been a big change because of Russia's intervention. So now this new ceasefire is extremely interesting. Essentially, from the beginning of Russia's intervention, there was a huge disagreement from day one about who is a terrorist in Syria and who isn't. And obviously, the Americans and the Russians have a different idea about that. They agree on Islamic State or ISIS and al-Nusra Front, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. After that, there's huge disagreements about who exactly is a terrorist organization or not. For example, Ahrar al-Sham or Jaish al-Islam, these are two big groups that are backed by the Saudis, and the United States do not think that they're extremists.
It's pretty baffling, because Ahrar al-Sham had a prisoner swap in 2013 where they got Mohammed Zamar out of prison, and he was a handler for Mohammed Atta, a ringleader of 9/11. So you'd think the U.S. would be labeling them as terrorists, but apparently not.
Well, as we know from most importantly from that Defense Intelligence Agency document of August 2012, two years before Islamic State was even founded, that the U.S., Turkey, and the Gulf and the Europeans were helping to set up a Salafist principality in eastern Syria. And this document, which became declassified by a judge, says that these extremist groups could link up with similar people on the Iraqi side of the border and form an Islamic State. Actually uses that term 2 years before the existence of this group. So we know the U.S. was backing all kinds of groups, and they continue to call them moderate. And we know now the evidence is in that they've been backing extremist groups, and even the so-called moderate ones, if they are intermingled with the more extremist groups.
Well, so nothing makes it more clear than looking at ISIS and all their Toyota Hilux trucks. That was the non-lethal aid that was given to them. And that DIA document not only warns about what could happen, they say that this could happen and admit that this is exactly what we want. This is the policy we want.
Yeah, and on top of that, the head of the DIA at the time, General Mike Flynn, was on Al Jazeera a couple of months ago, I think towards the end of last year, was asked about this document and was asked by the interviewer whether the U.S. was just turning a blind eye to what was happening. And he said, no, this was a willful decision in Washington to back these extremist groups. But even if there are so-called moderate groups, the U.S. is also training and funding and equipping, that they are intermingled with these more extremist groups, so that in the current terms of the ceasefire, even if you accept the American definition of who is a terrorist and not the Russian, these guys are fighting next to each other. So you would have to develop the most precise weapon in the history of mankind that will probably never be invented to shoot down and hit the guy standing next to the one who's fighting. These two guys are fighting together, and you're going to hit the one who's the extremist and who isn't. It's absurd. So we're going to continue to see Russia hitting extremist forces. And there's going to be disagreement with the United States of who they're hitting. And the U.S. and Britain in particular, they're going to blame the Russians that they've destroyed the ceasefire, etc. You know, they don't want to lose the West and the Gulf, particularly the Saudis. And this is not going to solve the problem. I think humanitarian aid is getting in. That's a positive, obviously, out of this. And the real issue is going to be when they start attacking groups other than the Russians, other than Nusra and Islamic State. And I think that that will collapse these talks. And then we're going to hear again about Turkey and Saudi Arabia's invasion. Now, it's interesting that both the U.S. and NATO officials never on the record saying, no, we're against this invasion. This has been not reported on very much by Western media, which I find shocking. One of the pieces I think you're referring to on the conservative news that I wrote, I've written series of three or four, it's about what this would mean, an invasion by Saudi and Turkey with the U.S. involved on the ground, because they won't do it without the U.S. Could lead to a potential war with Russia, and we know what that means, what the implications of that are. Now, when the Russians went to the Security Council a week ago today, or yesterday, Friday, last week, with their resolution clearly stating that the territorial integrity of Syria is sovereign and that no one can invade and no one should be shelling, as the Turks are, into Syrian Kurdish areas, the U.S. blocked this thing with their European junior partner allies. There was never a vote because it would have been vetoed by them. So why are they leaving the door open to this very dangerous possibility of an invasion?
And no real press coverage when Russia was bombing the illegal oil trades going from ISIS to Turkey, which is what got the Turks to shoot down a Russian plane, or jet, rather. Very little from U.S. media condemning the fact that how could these caravans be transporting oil this whole time, and the U.S. has a theater of war for their new toys from Lockheed Martin, and they've never been able to target any of these oil caravans.
Absolutely. Beyond that, the Russians presented to the UN Security Council a long document, which I was just looking at last night, in which it details names, dates, amounts of oil sold by Daesh or Islamic State to Turkey, and the family members of Erdogan involved, his son. This is all in a UN document, and it's never been reported in the West. And a Turkish journalist friend of mine who found this document online, it's not classified, anyone can go and read it, he wrote an article for two Turkish media outlets, and they thanked him for it, thought it was very interesting, but they would not publish it because they're afraid of the backlash from Erdogan, who is the president and shouldn't have power, by the way, because they have a parliamentary system. When he was prime minister, he had power. Now that he's president in a symbolic post, he still has power. They were afraid of him shutting down their news organization. I mean, it's absurd what's going on.
Well, he has been arresting journalists in Turkey.
Yeah. He arrested yesterday one of the leading Turkish footballers, the leading scorer, I think, on their national team, because of a tweet that he sent. So this guy is completely out of control, and he's incensed. Now, in the larger picture, they all want to overthrow Assad, the Americans, the Europeans, the Turks, the Gulf, Saudis particular. But then there's the regional issues. And for Saudis, of course, it's Iranian influence, and that is in the form of actual Iranian troops, Revolutionary Guards, and, of course, Hezbollah, who are fighting inside Syria, as well as Iraqi Shia militia. And for the Turks, it's the Kurds. They are Assad in particular, I'm sorry, Erdogan in particular is insane about the Syrian Kurds, who number only about 1 million, their whole population. But they have been a very effective fighting force against Islamic State on the ground. And they are backed by both Russia and the United States. And the idea that if Assad wins and they are rewarded with some form of autonomy, something similar maybe to the Kurds in northern Iraq, let alone independence, this would have an implication for his Turkish, a Kurdish population, which is much larger than the largest Kurdish population. So he wants to stop the Syrian Kurds, who are the most one of the most effective ground forces against Islamic State. The U.S. has recognized this. And beyond that, the Turkish Prime Minister Davutoğlu has said that this city of Azaz, which is between Aleppo and the Turkish border, will not fall. And what is in who's occupying Azaz but al-Nusra Front? So we have, again, and the U.S. is backing Turkey. Yeah,
John McCain's buddies.
Yeah. Yeah, the guys who are supposedly responsible for 9/11 are the ones that the U.S. is protecting and Turkey is defending.
Well, we're allies with Saudi Arabia. And Israel has also attacked Assad on a number of occasions. They killed the anti-ISIS commander of Hezbollah as well. I guess their interest is anybody against Hezbollah is their enemy too.
Yeah, well, their principal concern officially is the traffic of weapons and money from Iran through to Hezbollah, and it goes for Syria, of course. So if they want to knock out Assad and get rid of a Iranian-friendly leader and put in someone who's Western-friendly who will block that and choke off Hezbollah, where they could then go in and destroy them. There's also, you know, the this Yinyan plan that came out some years ago, and it's never been officially admitted to, but it does seem that it would be useful for Israel, for Syria to break up, for the entire region to break up into smaller states. And that's where we're headed, by the way.
Balkanization.
Yes.
Yeah, the Oded Yanan plan also outlined what happened in Iraq, and then it was reiterated with the former Defense Policy Board chair, Richard Perle, in the Clean Break Strategy papers, too. And so this has really come from an Israeli playbook as far as what's happened is exactly what they wrote down, what they wanted to happen. But they haven't been the factions antagonizing the whole thing. We have all these different players that you just named, different motives that have been putting this thing together.
And then there's the motive of the pipelines, mm-hmm. which I think is essential, but not the only motives of the fight. As I mentioned, Turkey is worried about the Kurds, and the Saudis are worried about the Iranians. But you've got the pipeline issue, and this leads directly into what is the so-called Plan B. And this has been around since the Brookings Institution came out with a report called Deconstructing Syria about 2012. I mean, very early, or 2013, very early in the Syrian civil war.
And yeah, I made a video about 500,000 people watched about the pipelines in 2012, which connects to the Israelis, too, because that Turkish BTC oil and gas goes down. It's non-OPEC oil, and it goes down and would slide through the Israeli pipeline before it could be shipped to China, because at that time, prior to the Egyptian revolutions, they weren't allowing it to go through the Suez Canal. So they had a monopoly, and this threatens their monopoly.
Yeah. And then there's the issue of Russia and Russia supplying natural gas to Europe, which Qatar, which produces a hell of a lot of natural, I think it's the second or maybe third largest producer in the world of natural gas after Russia and Iran. They wanted to send this pipeline through Syria. This is before the Syrian war began, and Assad said no, and he chose another one coming from Iran through northern Iraq to Syria. And some people speculate that the opportunity presented by the so-called Arab Spring, genuine democratic uprisings throughout the region, including in Syria, that was hijacked very early on by Saudis and the Qataris to back extremist groups to overthrow Assad. They thought it would happen within months. And then they can get their pipeline through if they get a puppet leader in Syria that would agree to it. And it didn't happen, and this war has ensued. And now we see Russia would also be hurt extremely much by that, because this gas would go from Qatar through these countries through Syria to Europe.
We should point out the deal that Assad, the $10 billion deal that they did sign on to as soon as the Americans were kicked out of Iraq, is the origin of that gas is the Pars gas fields, which are in contention between Iran and Qatar also. They feel like they are taking their gas.
Yeah.
So that's another factor in that.
So now we're talking about Plan B, and John Kerry yesterday set it on the record for the first time. Because there's a new RAND report talking about this as well, about breaking up Syria. So that seems to be an admission. Kerry's quote was, if this ceasefire fails, which everyone thinks it will,
then we're going to...
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to go to Plan B. And Plan B is to set up this so-called Sunnistan or a Sunni state in eastern Syria and in western Iraq, through which the Qatar and Saudis could send the pipeline to Turkey. So Turkey has an interest in the pipeline too. And Russia, of course, wants to, maybe one of the motives for Russia's intervention, I believe they're genuinely fighting extremism, and especially Daesh, because the U.S. wasn't doing that, and Russia's been a bigger victim of terrorism than the U.S. has been. But I also think that maybe the pipeline, they want to stop this pipeline too, because that would really hurt Russia.
That's part of it. Russia's motive is also they don't want this Sunni corridor going all the way in to link up ISIS with the Chechen terrorists that have been
Exactly. It's a 24-hour drive from Aleppo to Grozny. Yes, exactly what I'm saying. Their main motive, I believe, is what they've stated, what Putin stated, to destroy ISIS. At the UN General Assembly in September, in his speech just a couple hours after Obama, he proposed a grand coalition against the Islamic State with the U.S., similar to what the U.S. and the Soviet Union did against the Nazis, and the Americans immediately rejected this. And that was the way to go. And so the Americans got Russia on their own, helping Assad to win. And if they set up this Sunni state, there's a lot of questions here. Finally, I saw a quote yesterday from the deputy foreign minister of Russia, and we said he knows nothing about this Plan B. Of course, the Russians know about Plan B, but I don't think they're going to agree to it. And can it work? Will they allow it to? Can you literally have this state? Will Assad accept this? Well, the Russians are going to tell Assad what to do.
Well, all the Sunnis even accept that. I mean, you've got to divide even within the Sunni groups between these Wahhabi fanatics and normal people.
And what happens to the fanatic? Because this would be a lot of territory held by Islamic State. What happens to these guys? Do they just take off their whatever uniforms they have and become Saudi troops? Or what happens to them? Do the Saudis really fight them, even though they've spawned these groups? So there's a huge number of questions about how it would work and whether it would last. And it doesn't seem like a viable option to solve this war.
The language in the ceasefire is silly too, because what's to prevent someone from ISIS from just slapping on an FSA uniform again? I mean, there's no real clear language to say who's a terrorist. Well, who belongs to ISIS? Well, all they have to do is say okay and change hats. And it's silly.
Yeah, there's anybody who could tell you they know exactly what's going on that ground and who's who is already fooling you. So it's very easy to do what you just said, because there's so many dozens and hundreds of groups that, yes, they could change their uniform, the flag, ditch the black flag, and continue to do what they're doing. So this doesn't look very hopeful, to sum it up, this phase of the war, except Russia continuing to help Assad win this war. And that's probably the best outcome. Nobody who loves democracy would love Assad before the war. However, if you compare him and his multi-ethnic Syria, where he protected women, minorities, etc., and where a lot of Sunni businessmen who were very happy to work with him, to stay in his country because they were making money. If you compare him and what was Syria before the war with Islamic State or Nusra running the country, it's a clear choice.
Yeah, they
there.
Had 10 years mm-hmm. of peace. I mean, he was in a position.
The U.S. won't take. Yeah, U.S. won't choose that, though. Yeah.
As an Alawite, he was in a position of a coalition of minorities with this giant Sunni majority there. And so you have Christians and Alawites and Shiites and all together. So it's hard to abuse the power in that case. It's much easier for there to become a tyrant when his party or tribe is the majority. And so it's far better life under Assad.
Yeah.
10 years, not talking about his father or anything, I'm talking about Bashir, than the options that are on the table now. Nobody wants a Saudi Arabia 2.0.
Plus the price that's been paid by the Syrian people up until now to get this new option. I mean, the recklessness, the sociopaths that are running Saudi Arabia and Turkey and the U.S., for that matter, to pursue their interests at the cost, enormous human cost. They don't care. And they're going to continue to pursue the interests and find a way to win this war, even if they have to go to Plan B, which, again, I don't think is very clear it would work very well.
I don't think Plan B is going to work, but boy, we see eye to eye on this, which is why I sought you out. I have a question about humanitarian aid. Do you think it's actually going to be delivered? Because in the past, humanitarian aid is served for cover for just aiding the rebels and the rebels, terrorists. The terrorists were in Madaya, for example. They had stolen the aid and were selling it at exuberant prices to the local population. Do you think they're going to be more serious about getting aid to the people who need it?
I think what we've seen, yes. I think this is the main success of the Russian-U.S. collaboration here on this so-called cessation of hostilities. One figure Kerry put forward was 80,000 Syrians since this deal last week have gotten aid for the first time, some of them in years. I think that both the Russians and the Americans have clamped down, and the Saudis, on some of their fighters to allow the aid in, which again is welcome, but it's far cry from solving this war. But,
well, for no other reason, if they're not going to be humanitarian, at least it reduces the number of refugees fleeing to Europe. Sort of the right thing for not quite
right,
all
the reasons. That's the other issue about who's a refugee and whether some of these were fighters escaping from Aleppo that were rushed to the Turkish border. You know, it's interesting. There's a town called Dabiq, which is about 25-minute drive from this place, Azaz, which the Turk says will not fall. And it was in Dabiq where the Ottoman Empire in 1516 defeated various Syrian Arabs there and started the extraterritorial empire of the Ottomans. First victory outside of what the current borders of Turkey. So this is where the Ottoman Empire, you could argue, began, and it could be, where, if Turkey loses, where the neo-Ottoman dreams of us, of Erdogan died.
Well, Saudi Arabia is having trouble with the poorest country in the Middle East, with Yemen. Of course, they're using American air power, so junk that doesn't work. But Turkey is a much more serious player, and they did show that they were willing to shoot down a Russian plane. Do you think that their desire to prevent the Kurds from having an autonomous region south of them is really, I mean, seriously worth risking a World War III type scenario?
Well, they want the Americans in there. I think that's why they shot down the plane. They were hoping Russia would respond and attack Turkey inside Turkey, and that would perhaps bring NATO into the war against Russia, and Russia was too smart for that. They didn't fall for it. They've hurt Turkey in other ways. And I think Erdogan is an irrational actor here. I also think Mohammed bin Salman, the king's son, who's a defense minister and who's the architect of the Yemen disaster, as you just referenced, mm-hmm. and the Syrian disaster, that both of these men, their continued existence in power, and they're both kind of illegally in power. They've seized power to a great extent without any right. Their existence in those positions hinging on victory against the Kurds with the Turks and in Syria and in Yemen and now in Syria with bin Salman. So they really itching to go. And they are going to maybe set up all kinds of false flags. We've seen these Turkish explosions. There was another one a couple of hours ago reported. I don't have any details yet. On the border, Turkish-Syrian border, where some Turkish soldiers were killed.
Yeah, the double bombing in homes, too. I would argue it's questionable whether the Syrian gas attack wasn't a false flag.
Oh, I think it's
the third one. I mean, obviously the first two.
Which one are you now talking about?
When the UN was there to inspect the second attack.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden there was a third one, and they only killed out whites, and it just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll maybe get to the bottom of that, so you could only see who benefits from these attacks and what the results are. And Turkey, Erdogan has, you know, insulted Obama, which by saying, are you with us or are you with the terrorists in Kobani, Syrian Kurds? Are you partners with Turkey or with Kurds? And, of course, the U.S. is partners with both, but he wants them to choose. So I don't trust that guy. He could do something insane. I don't think he'd move the Turkish generals. They're not on board to a great extent, even though he's purged them to a great extent. It was the first thing he did when he came to power in 2002 was start going after the military, which appeared good at the time, by the way, because Turkey has been intervening in Turkish politics. Sorry, military has been intervening in Turkish politics for years, several coups. So the idea of making this a civilian army without any political aspect would look like a good thing, but he was really just removing his enemies in there and putting his own people in. But even after all that long process, many generals in Turkey do not want this invasion for obvious reasons. They don't want to invite a war with Russia, a potential global war. So But the guy's unhinged. I mean, there's no question about it. He's becoming progressively unhinged now, as he sees that the Syrian Kurds are advancing as much as they are, and with Russian support, and Assad is getting stronger and stronger. So his whole project, 5 years of investment in Syria, where all the extremists he's helped, and the oil being cut off, as you pointed out earlier. The guy's back is to the wall, and he's a madman, and so you have to worry that he might do something insane, even without U.S. approval. He's already shelling them. He's already bombing Syrian territory.
He did that right at, like, the hour of the first round of peace talks, too. You had the double bombing terrorist attacks, and Turkey started right when they're trying to get, even if it was the insignificant parties, to stop shooting at each other. Turkey says, we're going to do the opposite and step it up a notch, and started shelling the Kurds.
Absolutely.
But I mean, Turkey had been ethnically cleansing Kurds all throughout the 90s and receiving copious amounts of U.S. aid. I think they were second after Israel at the peak of ethnic cleansing in 1997, and then third behind Israel and Egypt for a long period of time, the whole time while they were ethnically cleansing Kurds. And then the irony was, later it turned propaganda for the war in Iraq. They were going to go liberate the Kurds.
Oh, yeah. Well, we know the whole duplicit history of the U.S. and the Kurds, and let alone how they've been treated by the Turks and the Arabs. We're going back hundreds of years now. So the Kurds right now are useful to the Americans and the Russians in fighting Islamic State, and it's causing Erdogan to blow a gasket and threatening to start a World War III, essentially. And I think the next thing we're going to see is the failure of the ceasefire and then an attempt, perhaps, at this Plan B, which I don't think is going to go very far. It could cause a new round of fighting. In that, I don't know that the Russians would allow this state to exist, or Assad certainly would not want it to exist. He did say, by the way, that he wanted to retake all of Syria. This was last week, President Assad. And Vitaly Churkin, the Russian ambassador to the UN, told reporters that that wouldn't happen and he better watch out, there'd be consequences. And we're not quite sure what this meant, whether Russia would pull back and give up some territory, or tell the Syrians to give up some territory, but I don't know if it'd be that much to create this new state under Plan B.
Well, they'd want to balkanize the area, and even if they did little mini states like a Sykes-Picot 2.0, it's still not going to have definitive lines.
Many people are saying that this is the end of the Sykes-Picot era, and we're going to see new borders after this. Not only in Syria, maybe in Iraq as well, Libya. I mean, it's been an utter disaster, the American policy in the Middle East in the last 10 years.
It's stupid.
Utter disaster.
It's stupid the second time for the same reason it was stupid the first time. But now we're talking about politicians, so.
Well, stupid for the people on the ground who should count most, but not stupid for the interests of the outside powers. At the time, Britain and France then, and now the U.S. and Britain and France again, by the way.
They're basically the same.
Yeah, especially in Libya, Britain and France really played even a larger role than the Americans, though we know Hillary Clinton was the driving force for the U.S. to make that happen.
There's a great video of Senator Rand Paul just really taking her to the woodshed over Libya, and she just doesn't know what to say or do. But
there was a piece in the Washington Times a year or so ago that where they got hold of tapes, and they found out that Robert Gates, who was defense secretary at the time, and the chief of general, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they went directly to Gaddafi and his family and tried to talk to him in a way to get out of this mess in Benghazi, because they wanted to avoid at all costs a NATO intervention. And they went around Hillary Clinton, and she stopped them, and she marshaled every bit of force that she could to make this intervention in Libya happen. And Obama is missing from this story. He just gave up. You know, he on Libya and on Ukraine, he's been a disaster in giving in to the neocons that are still very strong in his administration, or liberal interventionists like Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, Samantha Power.
Well, most of the neocons began on the left anyway.
Yeah, well, but in Syria, he has stood up to them when the so-called red line was crossed in that attack that we just referenced in Ghouta outside Damascus, the first chemical attack, a major one. And he stood up to them again when Petraeus and Hillary Clinton wanted no-fly zone and to give heavy weapons to. So this is why I was encouraged that he wouldn't agree to this madcap Turkish-Saudi scheme to invade.
The no-fly zone has worked so well so many times in the past, and that's sarcasm if people didn't understand. Yeah.
Well, there's probably one example where it is, and that's in northern Iraq where it did work.
Well,
the
Kurds. There's always a counterexample, but you know, when Hillary's behind it, it's just a precursor for Cocos Belli. I mean, that woman was laughing about Gaddafi dying. She's truly horrific person. Just, hey, we came, we saw, he died. I mean, that's psychotic. Just laughing about murdering somebody, sodomized with a knife. I mean, is that how a head of state is supposed to
connect? Well, in this time we're living in, they get away with that. That kind of megalomania and self-centered opportunism that Hillary Clinton's all about. It's about her. It's not about anybody else, obviously. And so people have to die for her to get to power or to extend American power, which would be through her. They're going to die. And as long as Hillary's, you know, the nominee and the next president. And unfortunately, she's got
more than Iran.
Sorry, war with Iran? But
with,
she wanted
with Hillary as president, it could happen.
Well, you remember what she said about Iran, that she was going to break, you know, completely pulverize it. I don't remember the exact word now. That was back in 2008. If Iran tried something with a nuclear weapon, she would completely disintegrate the country. So, yeah, she's not shy to use language like that, which is extremely dangerous, especially if she gets to power. She's lusting for power. This is what's really dangerous about Hillary Clinton. And we all could argue about Bernie Sanders' foreign policy not being great, but I don't think he has that level of bellicosity to him. He said he's not a friend of regime change like she is. He criticized Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, but he supported a resolution to invade Iraq in 98. He promotes propaganda on Palestine and on Ukraine and on Syria with the moderate rebels. He voted with Hillary 93% of the time. Like, people are getting excited over nothing. He's just as bad as her in foreign policy and even crazier on domestic policy. I mean, he basically just wants to seek out taxes to prop up overpriced industries in healthcare and education. And that, rather than just addressing the underlying cause of why they're so expensive. But
I'm going to stay out of domestic issues because that's not my field at all.
Anybody's better than Hillary, really, though.
Well,
Trump,
if you can believe his rhetoric, he's anti-interventionist. He gets it with Russia and he gets it with Syria. He says we have to fight Islamic State. He supports, you know, Russia in Syria, which takes a lot of courage to say.
He kind of opposed the Iraq War. At least when yes and no there, but he is willing to work with Putin, and he has a lot of business deals with Russian mafia in New York. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but he does get it in Syria. But I mean, I can't get excited about anybody in the presidential race. But as long as it's not Mark Rubio or Hillary Clinton, basically.
So Cruz is okay then.
Well, better than Rubio. Yeah, you know? I mean it's not even just the lesser of evils. It's just, I would say that of the most anti-war candidate left is Trump, but he has some pretty crazy ideas on some other things. And second would probably be Sanders, and he's not anti-war at all, but you got to compare him to like Hillary Clinton and Mark Rubio. And Ted Cruz has mouthed some of the things that Trump has said, but his record doesn't back it up. So I can't really believe it.
Right. And we have no record for Trump, so we don't even know if he's what he would actually do.
Yeah, we don't have a real record, but he was speaking out on it on television. He did call the housing bubble too. Like, so he, I mean, I don't know. I can't get excited about it, but I can't. It's something else. If you go back and read presidential farewell addresses from the past, I mean, even from Washington, and then you read recent guys from Bush and so forth, it's just really depressing how far we've fallen, given all of our advantages in education and time. And it just seems like from Kennedy onward, ever since the advent of television, it has just gone further and further down towards the lowest common denominator. And it's getting to circus level proportions now. But,
oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it.
But I live in Japan. I'm just kind of over here eating popcorn, watching the show. But
well, that's good. I'm based in Iraq right now in Erbil, but I happen to be in New York this week.
That's right. You traveled from there to D.C. and then to New York,
That's correct, yes.
Gosh, you got to be beat. I'm going to D.C. in a couple of weeks for the Stop APAC conference. So that should be.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's fun. Good.
Yeah, it's my
people. I wish I could go to that. Yeah.
Well, we're going to live stream it, so I'll make sure you get as close as you can. You should probably be in Iraq by then. So.
Oh, you will. I'll watch it.
Yeah, we'll Excellent. Have it in there. Grant Smith's going to be there, and Justin Raimondo from antiwar.com. Lawrence Wilkerson.
Who's written some good things on Trump, by the way. A couple of really interesting pieces.
He has. And Jim Loeb's there. I mean, he's tracked the neocons since the 70s, and I'll be there. I run anti-neocons, so not as big as his other names, though, but we're going to cover it. So.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time today. I think that was really good analysis and a lot for people to digest, because Syria is pretty confusing if you haven't been following it from the beginning. It's it's just a real mess. But yeah, and Consortium News, anything else you'd like to plug or other places you're writing? I was looking you up, and it seems like you're everywhere. Wall Street Journal, Huffington Post. You've been writing for everybody.
Yeah. And I'll probably continue to be writing for everybody.
Well, that's good. Well, you and Joe, thank you so much for all your time.
You're quite welcome, Ryan. All the best.